today is Huff v. Sheehan. Mr. Cummings.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jeff Cummings. I'm here on behalf of plaintiff appellate Yorlie Huff, and I'm here to obtain a new trial for her on her Title VII claim, hostile environment claim against the sheriff of Cook County. Most of the key points that Ms. Huff needs to establish to obtain a new trial in this case are really uncontested on this appeal. We have laid out in exhaustive detail in our brief the mountain of evidence that was presented at trial as to the discriminatory mindset and motivation of Ms. Huff's supervisors, Andrew DeVree and Fred Guerra. It is also undisputed here that Mr. Dormus, DeVree, Guerra, and Ms. Huff were sheriff's employees, that the sheriff was aware that Dormus and Guerra were supervising Ms. Huff, and in the course of their supervision of her, they took a variety of actions that altered the terms and conditions of her employment and created a hostile environment. The jury instruction given in this case is fundamentally flawed and misstated the law in a number of different respects. Number one, the jury instruction that was presented mixed in elements that pertain only to a co-worker harassment claim into the instruction for the supervisory harassment claim. That putting those two elements in there caused fundamental prejudice to Ms. Huff by requiring her to prove a couple of elements that she would not have to prove with respect to a supervisory harassment claim.
Did the plaintiff submit an instruction that was correct?
Your Honor, the plaintiff submitted an instruction that was largely correct, not entirely correct. That's found in the appendix at A10. The instruction that the plaintiff did submit at trial initially did not contain the errors that we're challenging here on the appeal, in that number one, it did not mix in the two negligence-based elements of proof that were found in the instruction issued by the court. Number two, the plaintiff's tendered instruction required the jury to make a determination as to whether a tangible employment action resulted from the pattern of harassment by the supervisors. That was something that was not present in the court's instruction that was issued, and that's another error we're challenging here. And number three, with respect to the affirmative defense component of the instruction, which the plaintiff's instruction properly advised the jury that they are only to reach that if they conclude that there was not a tangible employment action taken against Ms. Huff, it properly stated the affirmative defense component of the action by providing that the sheriff would have to prove that it exercised reasonable care to prevent this sort of hostile environment from arising in the first place, and then it promptly corrected the hostile environment once it became aware that it existed. I was just going to say that instruction was presented by the plaintiff, and it was rejected by the district court. And what you had here is the court then began working from the sheriff's instruction.
When we get to the instruction as it was actually given, did you object to those portions of the instruction that you thought were erroneous? Did you make that record?
Yes, let me make this absolutely clear. With respect to the affirmative defense component of the instruction, plaintiff objected, and the sheriff does not contest that plaintiff objected to that component. With respect to the inclusion of the two negligence-based elements in the instruction, there is a dispute on the appeal about that. But as we pointed out in our reply, and we've included in the appendix, at pages A29 through 30 and A38 through 39, you could see in the jury instruction conference that plaintiff's counsel trial did object to the inclusion of those two negligence-based elements. In addition, in a Rule 50A motion that plaintiff's counsel filed before the jury was instructed, there was a reiteration of the objection to the plaintiff having to prove, as part of her case, that the sheriff's management personnel knew or should have known of the hostile environment that was taking place. So that objection is preserved as well. The last objection we challenged on appeal, which is to the definition of a hostile environment, in particular that the harassment had to be severe and pervasive, there was no objection at trial to that component of the instruction. However, we are urging on the appeal that this is a rare case where you have an error that is so fundamental. And
wasn't that the severe and pervasive part of the plaintiff's own proposed instruction?
Yes, that was, Your Honor.
That point has been waived rather than just forfeited. The plain error doctrine doesn't apply to waivers, does it?
That's correct, Your Honor. However, if we take that part of the challenge out of the picture, we'll put that to the side, I think the court can still look at the instruction as a whole and see that it's fundamentally flawed. But let's focus on the parts that were properly objected to. Each of the errors that were objected to caused the fundamental prejudice to the plaintiffs, and I will just go through that in the following way. By requiring the plaintiff to prove that the defendant knew or should have known of the harassing circumstance that was taking place, effectively what you added an element of proof to a proof, but you've also rewarded a defendant, the sheriff, for its own ignorance. If it could establish that it failed to put in place a system or procedure to make sure that it was monitoring its supervisors as they supervised its own employees, it can argue, as was argued in the closing argument by defendants, that it had no way of knowing what was going on with its employees who were detailed over to this intergovernmental unit.
What you're saying is that if there's not there is a finding of a tangible employment action, then the affirmative defense would not apply, right?
The affirmative defense goes out the window.
Now, I have a question, and I want to try to bracket it. At the point when she did complain to EEO, and then they had an immediate investigation and went forward, and then 6 months later she's first transferred and then effectively terminated. Before she filed and after the whatever time it is, the time when, I forget the date, June, I forget what the date is, that this space of time goes on, what was there a tangible employment action?
Well, yes,
sir. We know all about the hostile environment, but what was the tangible employment action between that?
Between the six-month time between when she filed her internal complaint and when she was...
And when she first had to, whenever the time starts, when she had to show that environment or whatever. I forget the date. There's a date where this has to start to run because before that, its statute is run.
Well,
on Title VII.
Well, Your Honor, it's our position in the court did, we believe, correctly instruct the jury at trial that as long as there were actions of harassment that took place within that 300-day window of time prior to when she filed the charge, that under the Supreme Court's authority in the name of the case, I believe it's the name of the case is escaping me at this point.
Amtrak against Morgan.
That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you. As long as something took place within that 300-day period, you could reach back and capture all the actions that otherwise would have been time-barred under the continuing violation theory. And there was evidence that harassment was taking place within the window of time that you're talking about.
It is the harassment itself, the hostile environment, is that what you're going to refer to as the tangible employment action?
No, the two tangible employment actions that the district court actually found that there were sufficient evidence to submit to the jury and rejected the defense's motions for a directed verdict on these points. Number one was the denial of case leads, and that was something that Mr. Guerra was accused of doing. The case leads were essential to the career of an agent like Ms. Huff because without case leads, you're not able to develop your arrest record, and you're judged largely on your productivity in terms of your arrest and your case activity as an agent. If you're not getting the leads, and the theory was at trial, she wasn't getting the leads. Other similarly situated white agents were getting leads from Mr. Guerra, and her arrest record was not as high as it otherwise would have been without those leads. And the court concluded, and this is not challenged on the appeal, that the denial of case leads in this sort of circumstance pertaining to this employment was so rose to such a high level that it could be a tangible employment action. The second tangible employment action was when Ms. Huff attempted to transfer out of the unit that she was in to another South Suburban drug unit. I'm not sure of the exact name, but it's in our brief. That transfer was initially approved by the sheriff's chief of police. Mr. DeRee learned of her Ms. Huff's attempt to transfer. He came into the picture, intervened, expressed his objection to her coming over to where he was by the testimony. He did not want that bitch over there, and blocked the transfer. And that is the second tangible employment action that we are alleging and presented evidence of at trial.
That was somebody in another area where she was going to be transferred to.
Well, yeah.
Is that right?
Yes.
And he didn't want her.
He did, and he was one of her supervisors for years where she was. In 1996, I believe, he went over to another unit. She sought to transfer over to the unit where he was, got initially approved by the chief of police, and he stepped in and blocked that transfer. And as a consequence of that, that essentially, as we've outlined in our brief, essentially brought her career there to an end. She was subsequently assigned to desk duty, was not allowed to go out into the field. And after she filed her internal complaint of discrimination, the harassment started to escalate around the office because some of the other agents got wind of the fact that she was accusing her supervisors of discrimination.
It's more of a retaliation thing.
Yes. Well, it's a continuation of the pattern of harassment because one of the supervisors, Mr. Guerra, actually physically bumped Ms. Huff in the office and tried to intimidate her after he learned that she had filed this complaint against him and Mr. Dorbus. So I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Cummings. Mr. Halston.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Donald Halston. I'm an assistant state's attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee, the sheriff of Cook County. I'd like to begin by stating that...
Mr. Halston, this isn't strictly relevant, but is there some reason why this case took 7 years to get to trial?
Well, it actually predates my attendance in the office, Your Honor. I do not know the procedural history of why it took 7 years. I do know the plaintiffs did file three amended complaints and whatever process it went through to get there.
I have one other procedural question. Did either the plaintiff or the defendant ask for special interrogatories to be given to the jury in this case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
And I ask that because that's relevant to the argument I'm sure you're about to make, which is the verdict on the 1983 claims tells us what we need to know on the Title VII claims. And special interrogatories might have helped us figure that out.
Special interrogatories might help us figure out a lot of things in this case.
Yes, indeed. And one might think that special interrogatories are especially appropriate in trials that last 5 weeks.
I can't disagree with you.
Lots of complications in the trial, and it would be highly desirable to avoid retrials if we can. But here we are. We've got an instruction that you agree is defective.
Your Honor, I...
facing the prospect of another long trial.
Your Honor, at no point has the defendant admitted that the instruction is on its face defective. And I can get into that in a moment if you like. I'd like to begin by stating that the plaintiff has come up to you and in his brief and in his argument today and said there's a mountain of evidence against two people, DeRee and Guerra, and states that the evidence clearly shows that those two individuals supervised her on behalf of the sheriff and that those two individuals created a hostile work environment towards her. Okay, I'd like to state that, first of all, there has been no finding that those two individuals supervised her on behalf of the sheriff. That was a point contested by the sheriff throughout the trial. These two individuals were assigned from the sheriff's office, much like Ms. Huff was, to work in MEG, the Metropolitan Enforcement Group, which was a co-run entity between the state of Illinois and the sheriff of Cook County, where by contract the state of Illinois was responsible for the supervisory and day-to-day operations of that entity. The sheriff moved for summary judgment on that issue and a Rule 16b motion on that issue, and both times the trial court denied that motion but never ruled that the sheriff's, that Guerra and DuVree operated as supervisors under the sheriff's office.
And yet the sheriff did discipline one of these individuals, did he not?
Upon learning that the individuals in this case did act inappropriately, the sheriff did what it could to correct what would ultimately be, one of the individuals was returned back to the sheriff's office, and the sheriff would certainly not condone some of this behavior had it known and had it been under their supervision.
So, but isn't that also could be construed, could it not, as some indication that the sheriff thought he had some responsibility with respect to their conduct while detailed to this joint operation?
I would say, Your Honor, that it shows that the sheriff is not going to condone that type of activity whenever he learns about it in any of his and any organization where he is even remotely responsible. But those individuals were at one time sheriff's office employees under their responsibility, and at a future date returned back to their office, and the sheriff certainly would not condone that type of behavior.
Let me at this point, maybe just suggest to you what my basic problem is and let you respond to it with this case. This instruction is not good. The conduct of this trial was not within the normal parameters of the conduct of civil litigation. Why shouldn't we simply invoke Rule 51 and send this whole thing back, have it retried?
Because, Your Honor, the jury was presented 5 weeks of evidence regarding what DuVree and Guerra allegedly did. They were given that evidence. They were allowed to listen to the cross-examination. They were allowed to listen to the defense witnesses on that matter. The jury was properly instructed as to Guerra and DuVree to determine simply whether or not either of those two individuals created a hostile work environment, irrespective of whether they supervised on behalf of the sheriff, irrespective if there was any affirmative defense for the sheriff, just solely to the issue of whether Guerra and DuVree created a hostile work environment. There were no elements of color of law. There were no elements of intentional discrimination, as plaintiff argues in a brief. If you take a close look at those instructions that the jury received regarding 1983, regarding DuVree, regarding Guerra, the jury listened to those. The jury were properly instructed to determine simply whether they had created a hostile work environment with relation to Ms. Huff, and the jury came back for no on both of those individuals. Nothing in the plaintiff's reply brief can discount that fact. In fact, if you look at the 1983 instruction that the plaintiff gave regarding DuVree and Guerra, It's straightforward. It says, did they subject her to racially or sexually offensive acts or statements creating a hostile work environment? That those statements were unwelcome? That they resulted in a work environment that was permeated with discrimination, intimidation, ridicule? That the plaintiff believed the workplace to be hostile? And it's just a straightforward hostile work environment instruction. Counsel, Mr. Cummings, related to two tangible actions that would only come into play if the sheriff's employer liability was triggered, one of which was the actions of denial of case leads by Guerra. And that was specifically informed, the jury was specifically asked to determine whether Guerra on his own denied her case leads, and the jury once again came back and said no on that case. The issue of whether or not there was an instruction regarding tangible employment action does not come into bear in this case because there was no hostile work environment. The issue of tangible employment action only comes into play in this case if there were a hostile work environment and to determine whether or not the sheriff would be entitled to an affirmative defense.
You say there's no hostile work environment because DeVoris and Guerra were not.
Right. The jury was properly asked.
They found four of them.
That's correct. The jury was properly instructed to determine whether or not either of those two individuals created.
What comes immediately to mind is the jury may have concluded that they did not act with the intent required in a 1983 action, whereas the argument against the sheriff doesn't depend on their intent or the sheriff's intent either.
I'd like to make that point very clear, Your Honor. The question of intent was not in the instruction for either Guerra or DuVree.
Oh, so there was another error.
Which it was the instruction proposed by the plaintiffs. That there was that error in the 1983 claim does not mean you have to reverse this case. It actually shows you that you don't need to. They were not required to prove intent. They weren't required to prove anything higher than straightforward hostile work environment. And that's the reason why this case does not have to be reversed.
Mr. Halston, if I may change the focus just a little bit, could you point out to me what you think the plaintiff could have done better at trial in order to keep this case on track? Now, we usually place a great deal of responsibility on a plaintiff to make his or her case. And so my question to you is, yes, there was a lot of error, a lot of lackadaisical direction perhaps in this case. What could the plaintiff have done to keep this case on track, which the plaintiff did not do?
Thank you for your question, Your Honor. And this goes back to the judge's earlier question about special interrogatories. In an ideal world, there would have been a request by the plaintiffs to make rulings on each of these issues and or make separate jury instructions to deal with each of these issues. In hindsight, that would have been a more preferred approach. However, the defendants have demonstrated that even without those actions, the jury has shown you that they did not find hostile work environment in this case, and that the sheriff's liability was never the employer liability was never triggered.
Suppose I don't accept your 1983 argument.
Okay.
And that's the silver bullet that solves your problem. Is there anything else that the plaintiff should have done but did not do that would have kept this case on track?
I submit that the plaintiff should have proposed correct instructions. Although Mr. Cummings claims that that they objected to the combined standards of supervisory and coworker level harassment, it's clear in their Rule 50A motion that the jury instruction they submitted as their instruction includes those elements as their fourth and fifth paragraph under those instructions. Had the plaintiff's attorney submitted correct instructions along the way, I think that this case probably would have moved on a little bit better. And one last point is regarding the severe and pervasive aspect of this instruction. As this court pointed out, the plaintiffs did propose that instruction and at no time objected to it. I will point out that in the 1983 instructions regarding DuVree and Guerra, it's actually worded correctly and says severe or pervasive. So that's one more aspect of how the jury got the hostile work environment verdict out correctly. They weren't even asked to prove severe and pervasive against the individuals. It was severe or pervasive. And as this court is aware, plain error is a very high threshold to be met, and an error that is plain and affects substantial rights and seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of this trial, I submit once again that the verdicts on the 1983 claims demonstrate that this case does not rise up to that level. If there are no further questions.
I just have one. As far as the block of the transfer, the whatever supervisor it was from the other division he didn't want that transfer to take place. Is that you mentioned that the denial of the case leads, the jury apparently didn't think that was a problem. What about that block of the transfer as far as a tangible employment action?
Well, the instruction regarding DuVree, and it was DuVree who allegedly blocked that transfer, the instruction regarding DuVree was a more general request on whether or not his acts or conduct created a hostile work environment. I believe that would have been included in the jury's, that act would have been included in DuVree's actions, whether or not he created a hostile work environment or he had taken an action against the plaintiff.
But a denial of a transfer, it could call that a promotion or a better working condition or something like that, in just general terms, can be considered an adverse or a tangible employment action.
Sir, I believe that the way the law is going in the Seventh Circuit, that a denial, I would not disagree with you, that a denial of transfer, if the circumstances were proper, would certainly be considered by the Seventh Circuit as an adverse employment action. However, I stress that the issue of whether or not there was an adverse employment action did not come into play, again, because the jury found that there was not a hostile work environment. An adverse employment action only becomes important to determine whether or not the sheriff is entitled to an affirmative defense or not in the instance of when a plaintiff has proven that the individuals in question were actually supervisors on behalf of the sheriff of Cook County. Okay. Nothing further. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Holston. Anything further, Mr. Cummings?
Yes, Your Honor.
Switch is on the right. Lower down.
Okay.
On the right.
Oh, that's okay. I could do without it. Handful of points to make real briefly. First, Chief Judge Easterbrook, I was incorrect with respect to the severe and pervasive point. Plaintiff's instruction proposed, which is at A10 of the appendix, did have it properly stated as severe or pervasive. As I mentioned, that instruction was rejected, and we started working from the sheriff's instruction, and it was never put back the right way. Number two, with respect to the issue of whether these individuals, Mr. DuVree and Guerra, were supervisors for the sheriff, I would invite the court to look at the disciplinary records. Both of these gentlemen were disciplined by the sheriff. Trial exhibits 32, 34, and 35. One is a report of the disciplinary findings. 34 and 35 are the complaints that the sheriff filed with its Cook County Board of Merit Protection. And disciplining these gentlemen for, among other things, failing to properly do their duty as supervisors for Cook County Sheriff's employees and others while they were detailed over to the MEG intergovernmental unit. So there's really, if you discipline them as your supervisors, you know they're supervising on your behalf, and the people that are detailed to this unit have to be under the supervision of your personnel. They are your supervisors. Number two, getting to the transfer, Judge Mannion, Ms. Huff requested the transfer, which was blocked, after she filed submitted her internal complaint of discrimination. So she complained of discrimination. She sought a transfer. It was initially approved by the sheriff's chief of police, and it was blocked by
okay.
Mr. DuVree.
It was subsequent to her submitting
her internal complaint.
Okay. I draw that line because that's when everybody's aware of what's going on, and there's some possibility of retaliation.
Okay, and I think that...
And that's not before us. That's why I'm wondering about that.
Well, this is something that was also done by an individual who for years was engaging in this pattern of harassment and suppression of Ms. Huff's career opportunities. And finally, I would just like to say with respect to the 1983 issue, very briefly, Mr. Guerra, there was no hostile environment claim, Section 1983 claim against Mr. Guerra. So any verdict with respect to him on that claim could have no impact on Title VII. And with respect to Mr. DuVree, you're looking at a very narrow pool of evidence for Mr. DuVree on a 1983 claim, only his statements, whereas for the hostile environment claim against the sheriff, you're looking at all the conduct of DuVree, Guerra, and anyone else. So that even if you were to find he didn't do it himself through his statements, doesn't preclude a finding in favor of Ms. Hoff, considering the totality of the conduct. I'd like to thank you for your time, Your Honor, and request that this matter be remanded for a new trial for Ms. Yorley Hoff.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until next week.